My name is Maximus Decimus Meridius.
I am Iron Man.
Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Post Credit Podcast. I am your host, Eric Italiano, senior writer at BroBible.com. Today, as always, I am joined by my co-host, Cade Onder, who you could find writing about video games at comicbook.com. And today we are discussing the initial reactions, well, at least mine, to season two of Loki. I saw four of the six. Tired of the six thing, but but the four were good. And then we will be breaking down and reviewing Gareth Edwards, the creator. Now, I, like I just said, I've seen the first four. Cade has not. So I'm just going to fire off kind of my... Well, actually, you know what, Cade? You tweeted this summer in terms of Soka, but I think it largely applies to the sort of Disney Plus structure as a whole, that you felt unshackled and that you don't, and that you no longer feel the need to watch these shows. How do you feel about season two of this show as it's now 2 days away?
It snuck up on me. Didn't even realize it was coming out this soon. I don't care. I'm gonna watch it because you seem very excited about it, and so I'd like to talk with you about it.
If you weren't on this podcast, you would not watch
it. I think it would totally depend on, like, if everyone was saying, like, you guys should watch this. I think we're back, then maybe I'd probably come back to it. But I don't know. I mean, I didn't really care for the first season as much as you guys did. Are very high on it, so I just didn't care. I don't know.
Okay.
I feel weird. I feel out like an outlier, and I don't know.
So are you familiar with the work of Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead? They did that Netflix show Archive 81. They did that movie Synchronic. They do very heavy, dense sci-fi. So to me, they are a perfect fit for this show. And I think that is sort of the highlight of this, that it reminds us that what makes the MCU tick is, and I feel like it's something that they've gotten away from, where they sort of go for a director for hire vibe. For example, Sean Levy doing Deadpool 3. There is nothing from Sean Levy's career, who I think is a populous and largely disrespected but very competent filmmaker. But there is nothing in his previous career that says, well, this guy should direct Deadpool 3, the first ever R-rated MCU film. But Loki seems to understand that what you need to do is marry a character and creators who understand their tone. So taking Benson and Moorhead, who are like the ultimate melt your brain sci-fi guys, and to give them this show, it's just such a perfect blend, because Loki's journey feels at the same time both like wildly absurd yet deeply important. His world feels gonzo and bizarre yet felt and real. So I think that ultimately makes it feel like a real show with actual style and actual substance and actual tone and actual ideas, that makes it largely unique to the MCU outside of what James Gunn has done. Like, you can... So I don't think that this is quote unquote as epic or as sprawling as season one. I don't think that this is one of the best things that Marvel has ever done. But what I do think is, it's trying to tell its own story. I understand that Kang and Victor Timely are inherently the quote unquote MCU's next big bad, which the Jonathan Major stuff is a different podcast for a different day. But when you throw this show on, it doesn't feel like this is an MCU show. This feels like Loki is its own show. It's got its own vibe. And if you enjoy that vibe, I think it's a win. And I will just say that since we're in this era of like MCU multiversal storytelling and like time distortion and reality themes, what it understands more so than No Way Home and Doctor Strange 2, which I both really like, but I think are flawed, and Ant-Man 3, which flat out sucks, is that it has like a deep understanding of like the multiverse and time are like awe-inspiring and cool. But at the end of the day, they're actually both deeply terrifying. And that is sort of the lifeblood of the show. And that is what I like about it, because that's one of those things that I think about all, like basically all the time, in a comic book film and just a general life context. It's just the way the time is perceived and understood, and how we have such a little grasp of both of those things. So I think that show excels in that. The chemistry between its leads, Hiddleston, Owen Wilson, Gugu Mbatha-Raw, Jonathan Majors, Sophia Di Martino, Kehu Kwan, fits the tone of this series like a glove. I think all that stuff works. So bottom line is that I think that this is sort of the nexus point, to use a Loki pun, of an MCU show, just an MCU product finding that right balance of doing its own thing but fitting into the larger picture, which I think is what a lot of the previous films and shows have struggled with.
That's exciting, because as you pointed out on Twitter, this is the first MCU project that doesn't have reshoots. And while I don't necessarily think reshoots are always
inherent. And that's what I say. And then quickly, Kate, that's what I say when it feels like it's got its own style and substance and tone. Like, you could tell these creators had an idea. They filmed it. They shot it. Done.
Yeah, exactly what I was going to say. Like, I'm not inherently against the idea of reshoots if they're necessary. You know, sometimes people realize they need to go back and add things. But, like, that shows that no one at Marvel was like, you guys need to go on and do this. Sorry, you got to go back and you got to do this, because we have something part of the larger picture you need to put in there. This was a group of people who got to go in and really, they got to cook. And that's what we've been asking for. So that's great to hear. Yeah. I do want to say, even though the first season of Loki didn't blow me away like some other people, it is the most interesting of the Marvel concepts, and I'm excited.
I think
to see
you
how they
weirdly might like season two better, because it's a bit more reeled in.
Okay, cool. Someone who was on the same page as me was like, I like the season two more because it's more like fast-paced, frenetic. It's got a rhythm to it, and so
yeah. Whereas like season one, they're going to this world and this timeline, and it's very grand scale. Season two is more of a, it's like a group trying to fix a massive problem. And I think that that has a good and bad side to it. The good side is that it takes what is a massive idea of like collapsing timelines and focuses in on like how seven people are trying to fix this huge problem. But at the same time, it doesn't have that same sort of grandiose scale of season one, where it's like, we're going to arrive at the end of time and meet the villain, you know? Yeah. Like this. So I think that that's where of a bit of the disconnect is coming in, where it's like, it doesn't feel as scope heavy as season one did, but it also feels like there are multiple times where my jaw dropped and I was like, holy shit. You know what I mean? So and that is kind of what I want. There is a moment at the end of, so the last one that they sent out to journalists like me, you could see why that's where they stopped. It's like, okay. And so I think that episodes one through two were really strong. And then I think three and four slow down and contain themselves a bit. But like I said, the ideas and the tone and the look are all so singular that you're allowed to take a breath and just enjoy this world and not have to worry about the sort of cataclysmic consequences of it, while all of that stuff still exists in the background.
Yeah, I mean, like, I was very interested in where they left season one. Like, even though the rest of it wasn't, like, grabbing me, I was like, wait, hang on. Because the idea of Loki as a show, right, was this character has been isolated. He's been picked out of his world and put into this other weird thing going on. And now he's been even further isolated, right? Like, he's been isolated to like the 10th power. Like, it's crazy where they have put him. So I'm curious to see how they get him out of that. What goes on with Kang? I'm interested to see what they do with Jonathan Majors, because that's a whole thing in itself. Like, I'm just curious about this entire project.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that more when we break it down later this week, so make sure to tune back in for that. All right, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we will be reviewing Gareth Edwards, the creator.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time, the Roast of Tom Brady, a Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All right, and we are back. We are talking about Gareth Edwards, the creator. It is his first film since 2016's Rogue One. So that is where I want to start, Cade. I am on record ad nauseum about how I feel about Rogue One. I think Godzilla is sort of a masterful tone piece. And I think that those films are interesting in terms of, I think Godzilla's first act is its best. And I think Rogue One's third act is its best. And they both succeed at different things. But overall, I think it has put Edwards in a class of sci-fi filmmakers of this era that only the likes of, you know, to some, he's kind of in between Denis Villeneuve and J.J. Abrams, right? He is that blend of popular blockbuster yet deeply thoughtful sci-fi. So I want to hear what you felt about his first two big films before this one.
I've only seen Godzilla once. I saw it when it came out in theaters. And I remember leaving the theater. I was, what, 14 years old? So I don't know. But I wasn't a very insightful teenager. But I remember just being like, eh, it was okay. And then over the years, you know, I've seen clips pop up and I'm like, oh, that's pretty sweet. The Halo jump is pretty sick. Someone posted that trailer that was just pretty much the Halo jump with that horrifying music behind it. Awesome, awesome, awesome stuff.
It's an all-timer. It really is an all-time trailer for sure.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, I'm just imagining watching that in a theater, not knowing there was a new Godzilla movie coming out and just seeing that and just be like, holy shit, that'd be sick. Yeah. So that was like, okay, I was positive on it at best. And then Rogue One was also pretty cool. I did enjoy Rogue One quite a bit when it came out. You know, the Darth Vader shit's fucking amazing. I think Gareth Edwards is a guy who, like, whatever you feel about his movies as a whole, he creates really good moments. Regardless of the quality of the movie, the moments are there. I mean, the Darth Vader scene, the Halo jump, there's other stuff in Godzilla, there's other stuff in Rogue One. Like, he's just a really good understander of, like, blockbuster filmmaking and also creating really good, like, ensembles, I think, as well. I mean, I was thinking about Godzilla as well. Elizabeth Olsen, Aaron Taylor-Johnson, Bryan Cranston, and I'm sure there's probably some other people in there. Like, those three alone, like, weren't like massive at the time. Bryan Cranston was just coming off Breaking Bad, but those other two were like,
Will say that this is 2014. Breaking Bad ended 2013. Yeah. This was Cranston's first big rip. Yeah. So people saw this and were like, oh shit. Yeah. He was the quote unquote star,
I think, that they were pushing.
Yeah,
the
so, movie. And I think that that is sort of why I think that the first act is the highlight of this film, except for the set pieces, is because you've got one of the great living actors just carrying what is perhaps the most profound, like the most deeply relatable human story where it's we're fucked.
absolutely. But yeah, Gareth Edwards' like filmography thus far has been like solid. I wouldn't say it like blows me away, but like he's got moments in there that I'm like, I can call back to these franchises and think he's got a moment in there. Like he can distinctly place himself in Godzilla and Star Wars. That's crazy. Like that doesn't just happen. You gotta be talented to do that.
Yeah. All right, so now that we've talked about how he's fit himself into existing IP, let's talk about his original film. Cade, you saw it this weekend, so I would love to hear your sort of general thoughts first.
The Radiohead needle drop during the like helicopter, whatever you want to call it, scene was, I felt myself ascend. That shit was crazy. So that was immediately like, I'm on a high. But yeah, the whole movie, I was pretty riveted by it. I was surprised because I heard people before the movie saying this movie's boring. It's like, what? Even if you don't fucking resonate with the themes and shit, like there's constantly stuff happening. Like I did not feel myself bored. Yeah, it's crazy
because I think what kind of the strength is, even the boring stuff is compelling. Robots standing around, just the way that their bodies are held and the way in which they talk are in a genre that is literally defined by building on itself. Star Wars is based on Dune, which made blah, 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 and so on and so forth. I had never really seen a lot of things in this film. So the complaint that it's boring to me is everyone could have their own feelings, but I think that that's just factually wrong.
I think that's a weird take. Yeah. The scene towards the beginning when he's with that woman pulling out a robot out of like a car or whatever, and the robot starts like screaming for help. I was like, oh shit. Okay, this is awesome. Like, this is exactly what this movie needs to be. And that sets the tone very early on. And I don't think I've really seen robots humanize this extent. I mean, we've definitely seen like robots that you need to empathize for over various movies, video games, whatever. But like, this was a new level. They really feel, they don't feel like humans, but almost kind of like a species, like almost like a pet you want to protect. You're like, I get you. I empathize with you. You are maybe not us exactly, but you are within our world and we should coexist.
Well, they nail that with the kid basically in that one line where they're going through some kind of checkpoint. I forget the exact line where, but like someone asks Alfie, what do you want? And it's completely the wrong context, but they're like, she's like, for robots to be free.
Yeah.
I mean, so one thing that I want to point out before I dive into my general thoughts is that one complaint that I've seen and that I largely agree with specifically in the first act is that the script is a little loose and a bit weak. But I think that this is one of the most creative Chekhov's guns I have ever seen. Okay, do you know what that is?
The best guess I have is the Nomad, but...
Well, but you know what the term means, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Right. So for those out there who don't know, Chekhov's gun is a screenwriting theory that if you show a gun on the wall, hanging on the wall in Act 1, it must go off by Act 3. And the Chekhov's gun of this film is what you just described, the robot's sentience in its last moments. They lay that foundation throughout the film with the robot, with the soldier who dies, and then they upload his last like minute of consciousness to a sort of third party body so they could speak to it. And then that culminates in John David Washington's character being able to reunite with Gemma Chan's. So while I do have complaints with the script, I think that that is figuring out a way to check off gun. The emotional resolution is high level shit.
Yeah. I saw it coming once I started seeing how much they were kind of using this chip or whatever, but
I saw it when he said I would kill for just one more
minute.
I'm like, well, that's uniquely specific.
Yeah exactly. I was like, okay,
like I'd like at least 10 minutes to get a quick pump in, you know what I mean? Like, what are we talking about here?
Exactly. I was like, okay, yeah, that's gonna come back. But that's the beauty of sci-fi, is you can take such a big concept and ground it in something very relatable and very human. And I love that so much. And I mean, he did the Rogue One ending again. You know what I mean? That I was like, oh, they're literally doing the embracing in a explosion thing, which is crazy. But it works.
See, both times. And well, the Rogue One, and again, I've said a bajillion times how much I love that film. Not only do I think it's the best Star Wars thing, it's one of my all-time favorites. I do think the romantic beat at the end of that film is a bit weird. Even though they don't kiss, and thank God, they do still imply it, and I do find it a bit strange. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, even though I have major problems with the sort of clunky emotional exposition of that first act where he's like looking at photos and saying I remember this, and then like flashbacks of like that doesn't work for me, but ultimately it pays off at the end, because like once the fucking the Nomad is going down and like JD Dub, like I know he's dead, I'm like, oh wait a minute, we're about to get this payoff, and I know it's gonna fucking work. So let me get into my general thoughts, and then we will break it down sort of piece by piece. The number one thing that I came away from this film feeling is that this is a movie of dualities. It has both incredible style and substance, but I also think the script is not very strong at parts. Its world feels deeply unique, yet it's also largely a story we've seen before in various sci-fi films. I think it's one of John David's best performances of his career. I'm also not sure he's very good. The scale is massive, which, as you touched on, and these are my exact notes, Edwards has always excelled at scale. The Halo jump, the way that the Death Star looks in Rogue One, the way that those like walker things show up on that beach battle in Rogue One, like they've never looked bigger and scarier, right? So that is something that he really gets. But at the same time, the story is also grounded. It is a man and young cub story. So I love the way that these things balance both sides of the sci-fi coin. But I think the way that it stands above its peers in that sense is it is asking an extremely important question at a terrible time. And that question in it of itself is dichotomous. Most sci-fi films have long asked, what if AI is absolutely terrifying? And it is. And the creator acknowledges that. But it also asks, what if they're ultimately benevolent? And not only that, but what if they're actually better than us? And that is such a frightening idea, because evolution is primally, chemically, culturally, an existential threat to our being that we must, you know, quote unquote, rage against the dying of the light against. But what if that next version of us is actually better? That is both scary yet inspiring, stomach dropping yet heartwarming. And so to contain all of that in an original sci-fi film, I think, is what makes Edwards somebody worth keeping an eye on for every film that he does make.
Yeah, I really don't have anything to add to that. You pretty summed it up pretty nicely.
Okay, great. All right, so now that we've shared our general thoughts, I want to sort of dive into the nitty-gritty of the film. As I said in my review, sci-fi is a genre that builds on itself. And while this film did have a lot of original ideas, there is also tons of sci-fi films in the past that it is paying homage to, hearkening back to, building further on. So, Cade, what are some of the sci-fi things that you think Gareth Edwards were particularly inspired by here?
Blade Runner is the obvious one, right? With someone hunting down AI. And then also, I think the design of that city that they're in, kind of in the middle of the movie, is very
And then
Blade
I'd
Runner.
Add on the sort of the idea of an AI uprising. But yeah, we're in not like in the Terminator world where they're purely villainous, but here it's like, we just want to be loved and be free.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not trying to copy your list here, but like, this is a pretty comprehensive
list. Go ahead.
The Blomkamp comparison you have here with Elysium and District 9 is pretty good. I think Blomkamp does a good job of making like sci-fi feel gritty and in our world. He has like a lot of dirt to those things. There's a lot of that in this movie where, you know, the robots are cemented into our world via clothing and having a more grittier look. They're not clean and pristine as you might expect in some other things. Like, there is some real tangible texture to those characters. And then, yeah, I'll let you take the rest of these. I think you have a pretty better understanding of some of these other ones.
So, yeah, I mean, some of the films that not just me, but a lot of the film fans out there have pointed out is that the design of the AI physicality themselves, the way that they've got a very human face sort of masked over a robotic body, reminds me of Ex Machina. As you touched on from our notes, it reminds me of actually both Blade Runner films, whereas the first one is more focused on like a singular AI. The second one is more focused on the society of it. And then this is the one that I think is the most sort of contentious, and that I've seen it compared to Mandalorian and The Last of Us, wherein it's a man and cub story. And I've seen complaints that this is a very like I've seen this cited as sort of a negative critique and complaints that's well worn, to which I'll say, no shit. Like, man and cub sci-fi is a foundational piece of the genre in and of itself. Are we going to start to bust Cormac McCarthy's dead balls because he wrote The Road? Like, I don't understand.
I'm really fucking sick of this thing, because this has been happening specifically since The Last of Us, like, is when I remember really starting to hear this thing with Ellie and Joel. They're like, this is just The Road. I'm like, fuck you. This whole thing, this genre, has existed since time, like, began. Like, it is not weird for a bigger character to take on a child and take them through a dangerous journey. That is a fucking trope, and it is fine, and I love the trope, and I'm tired of hearing it cited as a criticism.
Kate, I'd say it goes beyond a trope. I think it's like a foundational storytelling pillar.
Yeah, sure. I'll take that. Yeah.
Like, you look at Logan. I mean, how many can we throw in at this point? You know, there is an endless list of like grizzled vet, young cub. We got to survive. You know, like, so mm-hmm. I think that taking this film down a peg for that is strange. And then I just want to say that there are obviously like war film vibes of this that we felt in Rogue One as well. Like that scene where there's that battle on the bridge and there are like those suicide
that
bomber
awesome.
Robots. That is Saving Private Ryan type shit where they're fucking defending the bridge. So it's like, you know, he's pulling from a lot of stuff and to do it all uniquely and affordably is just feat in it of itself. So to that point, let's talk about some of the unique things about this film that we loved as we both touched on the texture of this world. Sort of every little detail feels very thought through and well executed. Although it's obviously very similar to the Death Star, the Nomad felt unique and terrifying. And it was just a remarkable idea from him, both in terms of like storytelling and aesthetic, right? That first scene where they raid the beach and that blue beam comes down and just rips the water. You're like, what the? Mm-hmm. This is fucking awesome, you know? I touched on this before, the sort of mannerisms of the robot and the AI, just their body language and their tone of their voice. An offshoot of that is sort of the suicide bomber robot. We talked about the uploading of a dead person's consciousness onto a sort of third-party vessel in order to communicate with it in its last moments of being. This isn't really unique, but it's rare. An excellent, excellent child performance in which the film would not work without from Madeline Una Voiles, her first ever role. And then finally, them actually spending the money well. The fact that Ant-Man 3 costs like 2 to 3 times more than this is fucking insane.
Yeah, I mean, they went around the world and shot on real locations and whatnot. I think he said they shot like 2 things that they just couldn't get a real space for, like on a like a volume type thing, which so be it. I don't know what that actually is. I don't know if that's like space or what, but it shows that, I mean, people are going to probably say, well, the movie's not performing at the box office, so we're not going to get movies like this. People are responding well to the visual aesthetic of this movie. I want that to be a lesson that studios can learn and be like, okay, maybe it didn't make the money, but people are pointing out this specific thing is working. What if we continue to utilize this? I'm glad that Deadpool 3 is apparently shooting a lot on location, which is awesome. Like, that's why there's been a lot of leaks, is because they've been shooting on locations. Sean Levy has specifically said that. So that's great. Don't know if it'll look great, but I hope so. And then the other thing you said about the suicide bomber robots, like the weight of them is so cool. The sounds their feet make, them running through the smoke. It's just someone who has a vision of what kind of feeling they want you to have in a scene, right? Of just like, I feel like a palpable tension as I hear boom, 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 and it's just rushing through the smoke and there's nothing you can do about it. And then it runs past them. And I was like, wait, where's it going? And then it's blowing up like the structure behind them and not them. Yeah. And I'm like, this is fucking crazy. It's just clear, you know, for as many problems as one might have with the story or the writing or the pacing or whatever it may be, the actual, I think, direction of what's happening in the action.
The vision
is very much there and present and is very well executed.
All right, so not to be all praise-filled, let's move on to some things that we did not like. As I touched on, the emotional position of the first act, I think that the first 20 minutes are probably the worst, wherein they have this raid and they have these flashbacks and they have him looking at photos. And then there's even that scene where, and the character is played by famed country singer Sturgill Simpson. He just shows up to his friend's life and fucks his whole shit up. Wife dead, you dead, life ruined. Like that is very, and like Sturgill kind of being down with it the whole time. Like, yeah, let's go, John David. Let's go fuck my shit up. Like, so there are a lot of, I don't want to say shortcuts, but problems that come with writing a sci-fi film wherein you have to take leaps at certain points, and they chose to take those leaps in the first act, being like, we don't really have the time to show you them being in love, so we're just going to flashback the hell out of it, and we don't really have time to show you the individual devastation that this war is causing, so we're just going to bring in a friend and fuck his life up in like 15 minutes. So those are kind of the thing. I mean, I brought a friend to the screening and I turned to him and I was like, imagine your boy shows up and ruins your life in 3 hours. That's horrible.
I was confused. Was this the guy that showed up at his house at the beginning that he beat the shit out of, like, to stay undercover?
Yes.
So I'm like, yes. Why are you so keen to help him? I'd be like, man, right, exactly. I get it. It's cool. You had to do what you had to do, but I don't want any part of this.
Exactly. Exactly. And then this is both the small and big thing. Small because they pass by it. Big because it's sort of the crux of the whole story. The explanation of the LA nuke being a human coding error in one line of fucking dialogue is wild to me.
Yeah, basically like Y2K happened.
That's right. What they're whoops, saying. Sorry. Yeah. What? So yeah, I feel like they could have probably found a better way to textualize and enrich that point.
Yeah, I've seen some people call this movie racist. I believe, okay. But I do think there's been like a general misunderstanding of like the robots did do the nuke, and like, so like they deserve what's coming to them or something. Like that's how the movie views it. Like there's like the robots are bad, they're terrorists, whatever, I don't know. And I think a lot of people have missed this nuke thing being an accident that was then blamed on the robots. And
yeah,
I don't know. And some people have made some allegories to like 9/11, like, as you know, like the Twin Towers were bombed and then America used that as a way to go in and bomb countries, which I can definitely see that. Like that is a very like valid read of this movie, I think, intentional or not. I think that's pretty present in the text of the movie.
Yeah, and I will just say that sort of ties back into my point about this being a film of dualities, wherein they say, like, and I like this. This is a good point. They say that the West was largely, the West embraced AI until it went wrong. And they're like, oh, wait, whoops, fuck this. So yeah. I love the idea of something that we wanted to capitalize for profits turning against us, and now we are at war with our very own, not creation, because there's that whole thing and we've skipped over it all because it's the most sort of sci-fi jargony part of this film, the Nirmada character, or Nimrata, how it's like Gemma Chan's father and then it's her, all that shit. But the idea of like humanity creating and exploiting something, and then once we fuck it up, we try to put the blame on them and be like, we got to start a war now.
Yeah. I did kind of laugh. I'm like, this would never happen. Cause I was like, yeah, we have a huge problem. Ban it immediately. I'm like, we've had a gun problem for years. Not to get too political here, but it's just like, we can't get rid of the guns.
Right. And then they're like, right,
one
exactly,
problem with robots.
Exactly. And meanwhile, yeah, we've somehow found a way to banish all the AI to the Far East. Give me a break. Exactly.
We got them completely off land.
Yeah. All right, let's move on to, I've got two more points here that I want to touch on. Thoughts on John David Washington and how you feel about him as a movie star. Now, as I've said, I thought that the clunkiness of the first act certainly doesn't help him, but I don't think he particularly sells the romance between him and Chan at all, even though I do like the reunion between the pair at the end. That's more of a structural idea than an actual execution of performance that I like. But I will say his farewell with Alfie, which is the true emotional climax of the film, he fucking nailed. He absolutely nailed it. So I am conflicted as hell about him because I think his physicality is movie star quality, but I just don't know if he has enough consistent. He comes off, no pun intended, robotic as fuck at times. But then in the third act, when they need him to, he sells it. So I guess I'm trying to ask, do you think that this has helped or not helped his case as an A-list star?
I really didn't have that many problems with him in this movie. I've seen a lot of other people say they did not really think he's very good in this movie. What did you feel about him in Tenet? Same way?
Yeah, same way. But that is a emotionless film until probably the final like 15 minutes where guys are being dudes hard as fuck. Yeah, so like, right. Yeah, so I don't. So it's like it's hard for me to blame him for being stilted and gray in a stilted and gray film.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I think he's got like some charisma, but like you said, I don't. Maybe it's just a chemistry thing between him and Gemma Chan. I don't know. Like it is odd. Like, I don't totally buy their relationship as much. Like you said, it's more of a thematic thing than it is the actual characters and their performances. Yep. I will say he is cool with a gun. He's really cool with a gun, and he's like his dad in that sense. I think like Denzel looks cool with a gun. His child looks cool with a gun. I mean, that moment on the bridge. I don't. He does this thing with the pistol where you can't see me right now, but I'm like holding my arms real close to my chest and like doing a gun finger with like to the side. Yeah, you got it. You got it. You got it. Yeah, there it is. That's exactly what he does. I'm like, yeah, that's cool. And just like I've said already, that Radiohead needle drop. He looks cool as fucking that. And he's good at being like tactical. So he's got like the body and like the movement down, but there is something in those more emotional moments that I think he is lacking. But I don't think it's bad. I don't think it hurts his chances. I just want to see that improved upon in future movies.
Yeah. All right. And then finally, I just want to talk about the third act and the ending. I've got a sort of a plot point that I want to touch on, and I've got sort of a general theme point that I want to touch on. The plot point being, Kate, how did you feel about the execution of them sneaking on the Nomad, wherein they sort of like hijack a commercial flight? Like, I think the idea of a commercial flight to a space station is very cool, and the idea of them stealing that flight is very cool, but did you buy the manner in which that they did it in this world?
I agree with you with that element. Like Ad Astra had something similar where they go to the moon and like it's just like going to fucking, you know, the keys then,
or like the mall, there's like a subway and shit.
But no, I was like, they know they're on that plane because they try to stop it. It's like, why does the Nomad not just point a cannon at them and shoot them out of the fucking sky? Like, there's no way I buy that plane is reaching the Nomad in the way that does. I get that Alfie has total control of the actual plane, but I'm like, the Nomad itself could easily take that thing down.
I will say, though, that once they get there, I did like the way that they sort of pulled off the takedown.
Yeah. Yeah, I think once they're on there, it's fine. But I'm like, there's no way this plane should be able to make it there without getting absolutely annihilated.
Right. And then my final point, and anybody who has tuned into this podcast for a long time knows that I am an absolute sucker for romantic sci-fi. And I think that is ultimately why the third act is my favorite. And what ties this all together is not only do they have the genuinely emotional goodbye between John David and Alfie, which I think might be the best scene of the film, you know, them being separated by half a foot of glass, but it might as well have been a world. And for this guy who had not necessarily given up on AI, but had been given every reason to want revenge on it, to him come full circle and sort of understand not only the potential of AI as a whole, but the humanity in this individual one, I thought was extremely moving.
Right.
Not only is the sort of reunion with Gemma Chan right up my alley, that is the sci-fi shit I am constantly seeking. I was crying. There is no doubt about it. That is the stuff that hits me right in the core, where you're able to take these huge, grandiose ideas and make it feel as though you understand them to a emotional, soulful level. That is why I'm in this game. But then finally, the final shot of Alfie being on Earth, seeing the Nomad come down, and actually vaguely reminded me of Steve Rogers watching Captain Marvel fuck up Thanos' ship and just watching it tumble in the skyline, and just the outpouring of emotion that consumes her face combined with the background noise of sort of celebration of the victory of war. So for me, the third act is not only makes this film great, not only what makes Edwards great, but what makes this genre great.
Yeah, I do think there's some clunkiness in getting Gemma Chan's character to John David Washington with Alfie having to like drag her like avatar's corpse basically to John. I do think it's cool that they set that up earlier in the movie by him seeing like those women on the train that look exactly like her and stuff. I thought that was neat.
Right.
But I was like, a lot of the problems they face in the third act probably could have been avoided by not trying to get her body to John David Washington's character. You know what I mean? Like, had she not spent the time doing that, they both probably could have gotten off the Nomad before it exploded.
Right.
So it's like a little clunky.
But those are those leaf things. It's nitpicky. That you just gotta
Like whatever. It's still the moment is like, I'm in. I'm a sucker for this shit. I'm in. So it still works.
I guess the point that I want to conclude on is, what do you think that this means going forward for films like this, for the original sci-fi genre? As you touched on, it doesn't look like it's going to be a box office win, but it looks both like critically and general fan-y. Like, I would love to hear what my dad thinks, you know?
Sure.
And it seems to be connecting across those bases. It also doesn't help that it came out during the strike. There was nobody to promote this film. I asked Disney to speak to Gareth. They did not. I haven't really seen him talk anywhere. So I think that that has impacted how well it might have performed. But that's not me saying that, oh, had there been no strike, it would have been $100 million film.
Yeah.
I don't buy that at all. But I do think that that is a factor. So I think that, and then there's the whole point of this Disney film being like, hey, AI is not so bad, right? And we didn't even touch on that. But the fact is that this was Gareth's film. So I'm not going to get all conspiratorial about that.
They didn't have to make the movie, you know, like Fox didn't have to put their money behind it. They did.
So I guess, how does this make me feel about the future of probably the genre that I love most and the genre that I'm trying to personally write a script for next? I think it's both a win and a loss. Loss in terms of like the way that this would have 100% worked is if it crushed it. That would have been a no questions asked. If it made bread, we would have gotten hundreds more of these. But I do think when you look at even like, you know, distant cousin of this being like Jordan Peele's Nope, I do think we're moving in the right direction in terms of getting back to these type of films, especially when someone like Gareth can prove I can make this for sub 90 million.
Yeah, this could be a movie that makes its money back through, like, you know, streaming and stuff like that. I would hope, you know, with making it it's not a low budget movie at all, but it's like mid tier budget. I think that's great. And I don't know. I think you're right, though, with like Nope is not the same movie, but like it is someone who was had a vision, an original sci-fi script, and was given the money to go make it. And I don't think that was even like that big of a box office hit either, but like.
Right. And makes it look better than what it cost.
Yeah, exactly. And I like seeing that studios are still willing to do this in the age of franchises and streaming franchises and all that stuff. People are still going and trying to make these. We just need people to go see them. You know, I can't ask everyone to go see something if it doesn't, you know, sound like it's something that's going to be their cup of tea. But like, if you see something that's interesting to you, don't wait for streaming. Go check it out. You know, movies are cheap. They're $10, $15 at most to get in.
And I was going to say, $10 is being kind, Kate. I don't know about what's going on. IMAX. I don't know what's going on in your fucking cornfield ass town, but theater has not cost $10 since 2005 on the coast.
I understand that, you know, people are their families and stuff like that, but like it is something that, you know, if you want to see the change, you have the power to make that happen. This is one of the things that people can control if they go out in mass and do something about it. So if you want to see more original movies, go support them. And I think this is a great example of a movie that you should go see. And, you know, you may not like it, but it's worth always worth, I think, trying something. I say that as a picky eater. So maybe I'm a little biased, but at the same time, movies, try them. They're great. That's my message. Like, movies are great.
And then not to just dunk on Ant-Man 3, I guess, because it's on my brain, because that's the last time I saw Kang until Loki season 2. It's like, if you're one of those people being like, this Marvel sci-fi stuff is terrible, you have no reason to not go see this film. Because this is the exact inverse of the thing that you're trying to rage against. So if you want to contribute, and we're not trying to preach, and we are preaching, which, yeah. Sorry. And it's tough for me to sort of back this up because I do go to a lot of films for free, but I saw Oppenheimer twice. And I guess our point is that if you believe in a genre or a certain type of film, please go see it. So with that said, that is going to conclude our review of The Creator. Please follow my brother, Cade Onder, and all of his great work at comicbook.com. You could find him at Cade_Onder. He will be dropping his review of Spider-Man 2 on
October 16th on
October 16th on comicbook.com. We will surely discuss that game when we are allowed to. Make sure to please follow our usual co-hosts, always friend Brandon Katz at great_Catsby, and all of his work at Parrot Analytics. And of course, myself at Eric_Ital and the podcast at Postcred Pod. Leave us a review if you haven't already. We will be back later this week. We took off a whole 8 weeks, but now we're ripping off pods. We'll be back later this week to discuss the season 2 premiere of Loki and the season 1 finale of Ahsoka. All right, y'all. Peace.